Morning.
Morning.
In the 1940s, Jean Vanier, who's the elderly gentleman on the slide, should come up now. Hang on. There he is. Started a journey in life towards success in many respects, as the world understands success. He was from a very successful family. His father was the former Governor General of Canada. He did a doctorate in Aristotle's ethics. He went on to study theology, philosophy, and he taught in a college in Canada. And then he went into the Navy, and he was set for a leadership role in the Navy. In 1950, he left the military, not for the monastic life, but he saw that he wanted to move away from a naval career and look deeper within himself. And so he read people like Thomas Merton and people like that, modern-day monks. But in 1964, he went to a little village just outside France under the direction of a Catholic priest. And he went into this village, and there was a mental institution, as it was called at the time, just outside the village. And the Catholic priest was involved in ministering to this mental institution. And he suggested that two men with profound intellectual disabilities and a number of physical disabilities went to live with Jean Vanier in this property. And that was the beginning of Vanier's contribution, really, to the world with regard to us understanding disability. And he founded something called L'Arche in 1964, which is the French word for arc. It's a place of rest for broken people. So Vanier came full circle from an intellectual quest for knowledge through Aristotle, which there's nothing wrong with, but to come in to understand about the mystery and depths of life in God through those with virtually no intellectual ability. And L'Arche was founded on Luke 10:21, and it's interesting in a conference exploring mentality in sport. At that time, Jesus, full of joy through the Holy Spirit, said, "I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because you have hidden these things from the wise and learned and revealed them to little children. Yes, Father, for this was your good pleasure." So it's often said that Vanier's model is one of downward mobility, not upward mobility as we see in professional sports. Vanier himself said of his paradoxical journey, "The Holy Spirit created L'Arche through Father Thomas Philippe to reveal to an age obsessed with achievement, consider able-bodied elite sport, consider Paralympic elite sport, that the essential value of each person lies not in intelligence, but in the heart. Is this not the pastoral heart of UK Sports Chaplaincy?" Indeed it is. Henry Nouwen, who's read Henry Nouwen? Just put your hand up if you've read it. So, great pastoral theologian and writer. He was a theologian at Notre Dame and Harvard in America, and towards the end of his career, encouraged by Jean Vanier, went to live in a L'Arche community, people with profound intellectual disabilities. And he said that in his relationship with a boy called Adam, who had severe, profound intellectual and physical disabilities, he learned more about Jesus and God than in 30 years of academic theology. And there's a wonderful book called Adam, the Beloved, which portrays the story of Nouwen's relationship with Adam, this profoundly intellectually disabled man. So 50 years on, where is L'Arche after this act of charity in a village just outside France? It's an international federation of 150 Catholic, but extremely ecumenical, thinking about this organization, community in 40 countries. Here's a demonstration of the ethos of L'Arche. When you go onto Wikipedia, it says there was three founders, and Jean Vanier's name is not first. Philippe Sou, one of the guys with profound disabilities, Jean Vanier, and Raphael Simé. On Ronald Reagan's desk, the ex-president of the United States, he used to have a message, and it said this: there is no limit to what a man or woman can do if they don't mind who takes the credit. So, L'Arche, I've spent some time in L'Arche, which I'll tell you about in a minute, is communities of people with profound disabilities and assistants. And the people with disabilities are called core members. But the key ethos is that there's a mutual learning spiritually, and that the assistant can learn just as much from the person with intellectual disabilities as the other way around. So there's a mutuality which is present, obviously, in this organisation. I once asked 100 fresh-faced undergraduate students on a sports studies course, put your hand up if you know what the Special Olympics are. One-third of them raised their hands. I asked why. Why? Because they all knew about the Paralympics. It's because historically, people with intellectual disabilities, because of the age we live in after the Enlightenment and rationalism, the only way to understand life is through the rational scientific mind. So we live in this age. So people with intellectual disabilities, with low intellectual ability, are marginalised hugely. Do we ever see Special Olympians as heroes in Western media? We don't. And that shows the position that society holds these people in. Vanier had heard of the Special Olympics. And as I began to read the theology of disability sport, as I was drawn into this area, partially from my own brokenness and understanding of disability internally, I found these words, not expecting it, in Jean Vanier. There is a beautiful story of a young man with a disability who wanted to win the Special Olympics. He got to the 100-metre race and was running like crazy to get the gold medal. One of the others running with him slipped and fell. He turned round and picked him up, and they ran across the finishing line together. Last. How he prepared to sacrifice the prize for solidarity is a big question. Do we want to be in solidarity with others? We have to look at the poorest and the weakest. They have a message for us. And I ask, does disability sport, does those with physical and intellectual disabilities have a message for this organisation? I think you've already grasped that message. But I hope I can provoke you to think a little more. Before I taught on disability sport or wrote anything about the theology of disability sport, I was honoured to be accepted into a L'Arche community in Liverpool for 3 days. I wanted to see in real life what it was like for these people with profound disabilities. So I went in and I ate with them and I got to know them. And one day I went into this, it was a working class area in Liverpool, and I went into this little working class caf and I was eating my eggs and chips. And ironically, I was reading a book by Amos Young on the theology of disability, not sport. But his brother was a Special Olympian. His brother had Down syndrome. So he had a heart as a theologian to write about the theology of disability. So I'm reading it. And the next thing I knew, there was somebody about 2 inches from my face and thought, and I'm going to use this word extremely carefully, for supposedly normal people, we don't want people that close to us, do we? So I obviously went like that. And it was Richard, this 62-year-old man from the L'Arche community. And he looked at me with this huge beaming smile in the middle of this working class calf and just put his arms around me and he held on to me for about a minute. And all I could do, I thought, well, what can I do? There was all these people looking and I just embraced him. And then he came away, about 4 inches away this time. And he said, see ya. Went and sat down and had his breakfast. People, if you interact with people with intellectual disabilities, they undo you. They disturb us. They disturb our normality. Theologians talk about the tyranny of normality. In modern theology, that is heavily influenced by rationalism from the European Enlightenment. Thank you to Warren for inviting me. It's a real honour to share with you. I just love engaging with people from the coalface. I head up pastoral care in a sports department and I've done a lot of coaching and playing sports, so I just love it. And I think this, I've listened to people here, I've been in other contexts, and I think the Spirit of God is moving globally through sport. And there's two things that I just present to you. I think we've got a partner. We've got to come together and collaborate as organisations and individuals. And we've got to seek out the weakest in society. Because that's where Jesus would be. But he would also be in Premiership football clubs. He doesn't polarise issues like human beings. So the title is Theology, Sport and Disability: Reflections for Chaplains Working in Sport. My general questions are these. Does disability sport, both with intellectual disabled persons and persons with physical disabilities, have a prophetic message for sport chaplains? And why and how should chaplains engage? So I'll briefly look at disability sport, theological reflections on professional able-bodied sport, and then we'll look at disability sport and hopefully have a great conversation at the end. So I want to provide a context for theological reflection. You know, the social history in which you do theology or think about applied theology is very important. So in 1896, Baron de Coubertin and his committee, they did not consider people with disabilities. I'm not getting at them, that's the age which in they lived. They did not consider women. So nobody participated if you were female or disabled. It was a very colonial, white, class-based thing, actually, when you look at it. In the 1920s, there were some national organisations in different countries around the world for people who were visually impaired and the deaf. And there was some national disability games. In 1948, a German Jewish neurosurgeon called Ludwig von Gutmann, he came to Stoke Mandeville Hospital to treat Second World War soldiers who'd had spinal injuries. It's primarily just spinal injuries. And he created something called the Stoke Mandeville Games. Interestingly, Sir Roger Bannister, 4 Minute Mile, who was also a neurosurgeon, so Bannister and Gutmann had this affinity, he opened the first Stoke Mandeville Games. So he pioneered the Paralympics. 1960 in Rome, we had the first Paralympics, which is about the time in social history when other things were being really challenged and pushed. So we've got the civil rights movement in America. We've got women's rights that have been going on through the 20th century. We've also got lots of disability legislation and rights being pushed in American culture and then in Western Europe. So the Paralympics just didn't emerge in a social vacuum. It emerged in a context. Para meaning alongside. And there's been a steady growth. And the raison d'etre of the Paralympics is this: celebrating ability, not emphasising disability. Celebrating ability. In 1968, in the same context, the Special Olympics were birthed in Chicago from somebody who had a sister with intellectual disability. She started the Special Olympics in a back garden. Eunice Shriver. Somebody had some vision. This is now a global organisation under the leadership of Timothy Shriver. 2012, the Paralympics essentially came of age, didn't it? To a degree. We had lots of media coverage in Channel 4. We had media coverage in news media and so forth. So that's a brief context. Again, briefly, I just want to highlight some disability sport research and practice. There are two models of disability. The medical model, which sees a person as an object to be treated and cured and solved. The medical model comes from the scientific and rational understanding of life in the age which we live. It is opposed to the mutuality that is expressed in a large community that Vanier pioneered. The social model, which is popular with Marxists and socialist scholars, is that society needs to change its infrastructure. So football and rugby grounds need to accommodate people in wheelchairs, or whatever it might be. And that's been a hot potato in the media recently. So it's a political activist movement. And then we've got the institution of Paralympics. There's issues of embodiment. So what about the transition, the social and psychological transition to disability? That's extremely challenging, from able-bodiedness. Managing the body, and then the perception of the body. One of the best books to talk about transition and embodiment from a Christian standpoint is Joni Tada Erickson's book from the 70s, Joni. If you haven't read that, it's a wonderful testimony. And I'm going to read you her reflections on sport, religion and disability shortly. There's the old concept of social inclusion, what theologians would call belonging. We heard from David and Ewan, the athletes, yesterday about classification. So Anawafulu Strike, African female Paralympian and Christian who lives in this country, she competed in Beijing 2008, and because of a classification change, she didn't make 2012. And trained all that time, very difficult. Media, cinematic representations of athletes. One thing about this, people with disability hate self-pity narratives. When you read an article in the media quite often about people with disabilities, they champion the story behind it. They don't celebrate the ability of the Paralympian quite often. It's condescending. It really is. And then again, briefly, the Special Olympics, before we look theologically at sport. It's the world's largest organisation with 4 million athletes from 8 years old up to veterans. It's in 180 countries. It's evolved from a nice sports organisation into a movement that champions the dignity and worth of people with disabilities. In Los Angeles, there is a Summer Games, but there are Special Olympics events going on, hundreds, thousands of them all over the world, regionally and community-based all the time. But they also have a Games like the Paralympics. And this year, there were 6,500 people there. There were 4,500 athletes at the Paralympics. Have any of you heard of the 2015 Los Angeles World Games? There's historic reasons for that. So there is a difference, I would have thought, definitely, doing chaplaincy for people with intellectual or physical disability. And it was wonderful to hear yesterday that Andrew Thompson from Ulster Rugby has done some chaplaincy for people with intellectual disabilities. Wheelchair rugby is presented as an extremely competitive sport requiring the same aggressive outlook and physical excellence of non-disabled elite sport performers. Murderball offers viewers a window into the world of almost apocalyptic competitive intensity. Team huddles involve red-faced screaming team chants while coaches candidly claim we're going to kick the beep out of them in the film's climax. The message is clear. This is real sport. There is no feel-good here. This is about winning. there's a legendary rivalry between the US and Canadian wheelchair rugby teams. And from a Christian standpoint or ethical standpoint, you watch a clip of this. I did have a clip in, but I've taken it out because you saw some of it yesterday. And some of the things that are going on are really not that good. One of the things in this docu-movie is that they denigrate Special Olympians explicitly. If I'm right, I think when I watched it, they actually used the term mongrel, which is the word before Down syndrome. And they make those incoherent noises that people with intellectual disabilities do. Interesting, we have two people with intellectual disabilities in our church. We love it. They can't talk, but when someone's preaching on the cross, they make these noises as if they're celebrating the victory of the cross or something when the preacher makes these really important theological points. So this is elite sport. Human nature is consistent whether you are a physical disability, intellectual disability or none. But I think God obviously looks at the intellectual ability and knowledge of every person and judges them on that perception. So we have to be careful there. I thought some of you might be interested in this. Sarah Green did a doctorate she interviewed servicemen and women coming back from the Middle East with combat injuries. And she looked at how sport in these rehab centres had been used to rehabilitate people, but she also looked at their religious and spiritual beliefs. And it was funded by the Ministry of Defence. If anybody wanted more information on that, I'd be more than happy to put you in contact with it. So now on to modern able-bodied sport. Why do we need to quickly look theologically at able-bodied sport? I know Lincoln Harvey came to speak to you last year and he talked about worship and theology of playing things, and I might touch on these, but I think there are two reasons. To pick up on Matt's point yesterday, not to be taken captive by deceptive philosophies which depends on human tradition and the sporting spirit instead of the Holy Spirit. And I think the sporting spirit characterises much of professional big business sport. And also the second thing is to see how disability can act as a prophetic corrective to this model. And I heard that term being used yesterday. American commercial sports represent a prominent and aggressive principality, and one might suppose a more or less innocuous one. Yet the operation of this demonic power has significant political importance, markedly similar to that of circuses and athletic spectacles in Imperial Rome. William Stringfellow, writing in the 70s, he's quite a radical theologian. It's interesting, sports historians say that Roman sport is very similar in some ways to modern sport. It's about entertainment, and there is a lot of violence in it. Mixed martial arts, there are 700 churches in America who use mixed martial arts as a form of ministry. There is a church called Fight Church who has its sanctuary upstairs and its cage downstairs. Watch the Fight Church trailer and put your hands over your face as you watch it. It's crazy stuff. I champion the potential good of sport. I champion the moral good of sport. And we've got to be careful when we're thinking and critiquing culture. John Stott is the voice of reason here. If we become too negative towards society and its structures, we find it hard to believe or say anything good about them. So corrupt do they appear. Advocates of the new theory warn us against deifying structures. I want to warn them against demonising them. Both are extremes to avoid. And I think we've got to think carefully about that. So very quickly, to provide a context for how we've got to this state of able-bodied sport, this is a very broad brushstroke. Amateur sport, 19th century, the whole chariots of fire thing. Not to go into that in great detail. It's about the taking part. It's about honouring your opponent and all these sorts of things. But there was already in Chariots of Fire this wrestling between professionalism and amateurism going on in the narrative of the story. Then you've got the radio evolved in the 20s and the widespread use of television in the 50s. Sport now has a vehicle to be commodified, because sport can be sold through the television with sponsorship and rights. So in the 1960s, while there were professional sports before then, such as baseball, boxing, football, racehorsing, institutionally, sport became professional because it got into bed with the free market economy in about the 1960s. Whenever you put lots of money together in human beings, there's problems if their hearts aren't surrendered to Jesus. What's interesting is this. When did sports studies courses in universities start? In the 1960s. Sports ethics, sports philosophy, sports sociology, sports psychology. Why? Because there was money to pay psychologists and biomechanists and so forth. My question to my secular sports ethics friends, gently, is this. There's been 40 years of sports ethics literature. There are journals coming out of people's ears. There are all this programming. But sport is arguably more corrupt now than it was when those writings started in the 1960s. What's the problem? The problem is spiritual. It's men's and women's hearts. I'm not rubbishing the sports ethics programs, but it's a spiritual issue in sport. Forbes said that in 2014-15, the top 100 athletes earned £3.2 billion. What a figure. Tiger Woods became the first billionaire athlete. Let's get a little bit more specific. I'm not going through all of these, but I notice on the website of this organisation it says, our priority is not winning at all costs. It's people, relationships that matter. So I'm not going to dwell on these issues, but a lot of pastoral issues come out of these bullet points. I'll just give you one example. If Baron de Coubertin could see that this was happening in Olympic and elite sport, I think he might be quite surprised. Surgical enhancements, not corrective to enhance performance. There are baseball players who are having invasive surgery under general anaesthetic to tighten the rotator cuff muscles in the shoulder to create more power and to protect them from injury. It's not corrective surgery, but they're having surgery to enhance performance. Genetically modified athletes are on the horizon. There are books written on this topic. Parents choosing to have embryos modified become good athletes. Scary stuff, theologically. The last two slides, I want you to consider this. Sport is a neutral cultural artifact, like the arts or music or any of these other things. But when you introduce human heart into these activities, there is potential for good or evil. So it's not that sport is evil. I believe some sports like mixed martial arts and boxing, this is another lecture or a discussion, but where intentional violence is ordained within the rules, I don't believe they're healthy sports. There are other sports with violence in, but it's not ordained within the rules. Let's get positive. We heard David and Ewan use these words. Excellence, joy, enjoyment. A lack of playfulness and enjoyment for David led to him not enjoying sport and getting into a degree of despair. When he started playing sport for just sport's sake, he got his enjoyment back. Beauty, sacrifice, friendship. Zach Johnson, an evangelical Christian, recently won the British Open golf. I think his life, both his life, his incarnational message, his sermon, and the words that he speaks is a real testimony to Jesus. I think he carries his greatness lightly. I like that. Roger Federer, he's not a Christian, but he carries this degree of humility and grace about him. And isn't his backhand beautiful? He dances along that line, and Nadal's at the other end. And, you know, they're so different players, but I just love watching Nadal. The aesthetics, the beauty of it. And there is something called common grace, which is different to salvational grace that we receive through the Christ cross. Sports competition, from the root meaning, means this: a mutual striving together for excellence. And as Christians, if I was to play against Matt a game of tennis, if I didn't bring my game and really go after Matt, I wouldn't be honouring him. I see no problem in fervent, intense competition. But it's about the state of the heart. If I start to want to denigrate him, dominate him, then I've stepped over the line from a spiritual standpoint. There's nothing wrong with competition. It's the human heart within it which defiles it. In the opening to Chariots of Fire, Eric Liddell's father, they're talking about whether he should go to China to be a missionary or he should become an Olympic athlete. And his father says, if a Christian peels potatoes with excellence and does it to the glory of the Lord, then so be it. And he's basically saying, seek excellence, son, in life. Go and do it, but do it with a humble heart. And Eric did, and he's all our heroes to a degree, isn't he? So we have to be present in cultural settings. YWAM and Youth for Christ, many years ago, the leaders of those organisations got together and they talked about invading the seven mountains of culture. So education, business, family, entertainment and so forth. And there's three things which have come out of this approach. Is, as Christians, we need to display excellence. I think there's been a great amount of false humility in the church historically. We need to serve others, and we need to do it led by the Holy Spirit, God's wisdom, knowing when to say things and not to say things. I liked Warren's analogy yesterday about he had to go back to the car to just check out with God. How many times do we compartmentalize things? I'm now going to read you what Joni Tardy Erickson thinks about sport, faith and disability. So Joni dived into a lake in the 1970s, hit her head on the bottom and became a quadriplegic. She has an incredible testimony, and her verse is Paul's words of strength in weakness. She's lived a life through that. Not long after the accident in which I became a spinal cord injured quadriplegic, I met Brad Parks, the legendary inspiration behind the sport of wheelchair tennis. It was at a LA disability exposition, and I was getting courtside watching, when he wheeled over and asked, "Want to give it a try?" For me, a lover of tennis, when I was on my feet and a quad who could still remember what it felt like to wrap my fingers around a racket's handle, his question left me breathless. Does this guy really think I can still swing a backhand? A few minutes and much duct tape later, I was on court. Yes, my arm muscles were weak, and yes, racing to the net in a power wheelchair was not pretty, but I was doing it. I was in the sport. The athlete that I still was on the inside had found an outlet, albeit feeble, to express all my athleticism that was still bottled up. A few minutes later, exhausted, I wheeled off the pavement as I was stepping off the back court of heaven, and I felt free. Is there a connection between sport, disability and religion? I'm living proof that there is. That brief afternoon on Brad's tennis court ignited a happy-hearted effusion of praise and thanksgiving to God. What a gift God had given me. And to this day, whenever I spend time with other sports people with disabilities, I sense a special connection, like a brotherhood. For as we sit in our wheelchairs and share sporting memories, there is also a shared light in our eyes. We recognise that we've experienced something truly exceptional that binds us together. People with an intellectual or physical disability call society into question when its values are solely concerned with physical prowess or appearances, speed or efficiency. It's also a challenge to those with impairments who may refuse to explore the blessings often found in weakness. Jesus was crucified in weakness, the Bible teaches. According to the values of the 21st century, he was the greatest failure in human history. Think about Isaiah 53. There was nothing great in his appearance. My husband and I just returned from Hawaii, where he took me snorkeling. Yes, it was another activity that did not look pretty. Trust me, managing a quad in the water with a binder and leg bag is not pretty. But I came face to face with a giant sea turtle while floating face down. It felt as though the turtle and I were in the sport together, bobbing in the current and delighting in our freedom from gravity. Once again, I came up out of the water as I was emerging from my baptism. It was indeed a spiritual experience, freeing and positively liberating. God uses many things to whet our appetite for his liberating life, and sport may be his most clever way of doing it. Wonderful testimony. Enough of revelling in the beauties of sport. Back to the critique. Olympic consultant sport psychiatrist said this: if there's any character trait that is anathema to an athlete, it is that of weakness. Being unable to handle one's feelings and confessing that inability to another human being in intimate conversation is not usually concordant with an athlete's sense of mastery. The role of professional athlete may increase the risk of suffering a specific narcissistic vulnerability, and retirement from sports at any level carries with it an increased risk of clinical depression, especially if the retirement is forced by injury or waning abilities. You guys know this better than me, don't you? You do this day to day. Jesus was crucified in weakness. Paul, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, for when I am weak, I'm strong. I don't know about you, but in the times when things are difficult and we suffer, God can manifest in excellence, but so often I've learned so much more from Jesus through the difficult stuff. When I've felt very vulnerable and extremely weak. If the Spirit of Jesus does not live in the human heart, other things occupy it. Theologians have called these life projects: sport, education, family. Some of these, they're all good things, potentially. Idols are often held in the heart via pride or fear. Not always, but fear is quite often behind pride. I know Mother Teresa said there are two states of heart fundamentally in the world: fear and love. Because pride really is fearful at base, because it's a fear of insignificance. It's a fear of not being at the top. It's a God-shaped hole. John White says sport is an idol factory. Keller, hubris is the normal Greek word used to describe pride in the Bible. Well, Timothy Keller, in his short but pretty profound book, says this word, physio, if I pronounce it correctly, it means to be overinflated, swollen, distended beyond its proper size. He says there are four characteristics to the natural human ego that hasn't been redeemed and is being redeemed as we let go of the old man or woman. It's empty, it's painful, it's busy, and it's fragile. So the ego is easily hurt and offended. It's painful and fragile. Phil mentioned that when you're rejected in a sports chaplaincy context, if your heart surrendered to Jesus, the offence will be minimal.
Yeah.
You walk away. You'll be all right because you're absolutely rooted in Jesus' love. If you compare yourself with other, that's not necessarily a good thing. C.S. Lewis says pride is essentially competitive. So competition is not wrong. But any competitive environment leads to the potential for pride arising. And it's devoid of a spiritual foundation, the ego. It is empty. The Message version of Proverbs 16:18. First pride, then the crash. The bigger the ego, the harder the fall. I've been writing something on this, and I felt a conviction not to write about any individual athletes. I'd written a couple of paragraphs on Tiger Woods and Lance Armstrong, and felt a conviction actually to take it out in that context, but I felt like I could share it here, given that I think we all understand that we're in no better position to them fundamentally. My life, I had a great deal of abandonment and rejection from my adoption and the mess of my life after that. And I always used to feel incredibly insecure and rejected and lonely in a room of people until I got to know God as my Father. But I have a resonance for maybe some of the experiences of people with disabilities. And that's why I think I was led into this area. So I don't judge Lance or Tiger in any way, shape or form. Our response, if we have a heart of humility that doesn't get offended at pride, because offence at pride just shows us how proud our own hearts are. It's difficult. But here's something. Seeing beyond the facade of the drivenness and the competence of Lance and Tiger, both of them come from fatherlessness. I had a fatherless spirit because of the brokenness of my own heart from adoption. Lance Armstrong's biological father wasn't around, and his stepfather used to beat him with a paddle. Tiger Woods, you might think, well, his father, Earl Woods, their relationship was championed. But I read a book after Earl's death by a journalist, and Earl Woods was a serial adulterer. And the journalist interviewed a girlfriend of Tiger Woods when he was 14. And a few times he'd come to her house crying his eyes out, saying, "My dad's gone and done it again." So we see Tiger and Lance, but spiritually, there are two broken little children in their hearts which need mending. And that's where chaplains can engage. So we move toward the prophetic role of disability. Team Hoyt. Some of you may have seen this on YouTube. I'm going to show you the official DVD of Team Hoyt, which is about 10 to 15 minutes. But I think it'll say far more than me standing up here for 10 to 15 minutes. Just turn the sound up, please. Thank you.
Registration for the 25th Ironman continues one by one. Some faces we recognize. Here is 58-year-old Richard Holcomb, number 214, back for a second try. He's legally blind and it doesn't matter to him. No, the thing that must occur at all costs is this time, cross the line.
It's more than a race. It's a lifetime event that we'll remember for the rest of our lives. You're either going to carry me off the course, or I'm going to cross the finish line.
The stories about people like Richard Holcomb pass through this world as race week moves toward this morning. Hey, did you hear about the man who is legally blind? People love to tell and love to hear the stories. Then, appearing near the start line, where they've been before, are father and son, Dick and Ricky Hoyt. There is no one here who hasn't heard about them, their story, and a human commitment that goes far beyond and far back.
January 10th, 1962. We knew there was something wrong, but we did not know exactly what. The doctor said, forget Rick. Put him away. Put him in an institution. He's going to be nothing but a vegetable for the rest of his life. We cried a little bit. We talked, and we said, no, we're not going to put Rick away. I'm going to bring Rick home. Bring him up like any other child. We knew Rick was smart. We could tell by looking in his eyes. And when we talked to him, he was paying attention to what we were saying. So we wanted to get a computer built so Rick could communicate with us. Everybody came to our house that night for Rick to say his first words, and everybody was betting. You know, what is the first words Rick is ever going to say? His mom's saying, it's going to be, hi, Mom. And me, the dad, saying, no, it's going to be, hi, Dad. Well, the Boston Bruins were going for the Stanley Cup, and the very first words Rick ever said was, go, Bruins.
Dick is a military man, so he knows a thing or two about commitment. This time, he's just months removed from a heart attack. This gift that he gives to his son, or is it the other way around? Either way, it all started when Rick heard about a charity run for a paralyzed athlete. He asked Dad, and Dad said yes.
The gun went off, and we went off with all the other runners, and everybody thought that Rick and I would just go to the corner and turn around and come back. Well, we didn't. We finished the whole 5 miles, coming in next to last, but not last. And when we got home that night, Rick wrote on his computer, Dad, when I'm running, it feels like my disability disappears. So that was a very powerful message to me, that we finally found a sport that Rick could get involved in just like everybody else. Rick is my motivator. He inspires me. To me, he's the one out there competing, and I'm just loaning him my arms and my legs so that he can compete. There's just something that gets into me when I'm out there competing with Rick that I can't explain it, and we're able to go faster. And it's just an unbelievable feeling. Rick and I love the Ironman triathlon, to be out there competing with the best triathletes in the world, to be accepted to compete along with these triathletes. Just to be out there on that pier with all the other triathletes and then waiting in the water for that cannon to go off, it was just so exciting. The feeling coming down the finish line at Leahy Drive, it's just an awesome experience with the crowd there. All the excitement, the noise, and the announcers announcing all the adrenaline just gets flowing.
Time to get to know me, they will realize that I am.
graduated from public high school. He's graduated from college. He's out there competing in road races and triathlons. He lives a happier life probably than 95% of the population. Rick would tell you that, you know, if he was physically able to do something, that he'd probably play basketball, football, hockey. But then he always says, no, the first thing he'd do is sit down and have me sit down in his wheelchair and he'd push me. You know, it really makes me feel good that you know, he appreciates, you know, what I'm trying to do to help him out, and he'd do the same thing for me. Our message is, yes, you can. You can do anything you want to do as long as you make up your mind. You can do it.
If you have ever searched for the meaning of life, stop. The answer lies right here. By the way, Ricky would want us to tell you, the Bruins look pretty good this year.
When I show that to students, there's normally lots of girls getting hankies out of the bags, and there's lots of rugby and football lads looking down at the feet, and there's lots of sniffling going on. But it's a prophetic thing. Just a couple of comments on it. What he didn't say, I've read a couple of books on the Team Hoyt story, and that it was actually their pastor who came round to their house. When this happened, they found out he was disabled. He had spastic quadriplegia, so he's not intellectually disabled. And he said, you have two paths here. You can put him in an institution, or you can love him like anybody else. So there was real spiritual input at that point, which when you think about what's come out of it. I had a concern when I first saw this, that the father was vicariously living through the son. That was a slight concern for me. Then I found out that Rick isn't intellectually disabled. He has a degree from Boston University. And I do believe they do have Christian beliefs. I contacted them. I wrote to them because I wanted to interview them and write something on it. And they said they were too busy and stuff. But incredibly, when I went into the last community, I met a father and son. The son's profoundly intellectually disabled and blind from birth. And I actually was able to interview them. They'd run like 40 marathons together and stuff, very similar. So God gave me a Team Hoyt in Liverpool.
Sorry, can I just make a comment? I have raced with Team Hoyt in 2007.
Yeah.
And the thing that struck me most about them was how completely, totally humble.
Yeah. Well, I was going to close. Thank you for that, in saying that it's an incredible metaphor for God the Father. It's a metaphor that breaks down, and a dependent, weak son or daughter that we all are. We're all broken before the beauty of the Lord, every one of us, according to Isaiah. So a few reflections on this, and then I don't know whether we're going to have coffee or wrap up. Does anybody know who this guy is? Oswald Chambers. I love his work, but it's painful to read because it points back at you. So what's our starting point with regard to our mentality? It's got to be that we're all disabled. We were all disabled spiritually before we knew Jesus. And Moltmann, a theologian, says this: a person with disabilities gives others the precious insight into the woundedness and weakness of human life. I kept disability sport at arm's length for a number of years, but a number of things, such as marrying my wife, who is a dentist for people with intellectual disabilities, sharing stories over the breakfast table. A governor of York, St. Johnson. Have you ever thought about disability? My daughter's got special... All these little God incidences drew me into this area, and I couldn't keep it at arm's length any longer. The reason I've got Oswald up there, in his incredible biography called Abandoned to God, he was at the edge of psychic collapse. That was his words. In Yorkshire, we say, at the end of your tether. There was somebody in the congregation that at that time they called Daft Meg. It was a little girl who had intellectual disabilities. And in the middle of this talk, she walked up to Oswald at the front with some wilted flowers, and it had a little message attached to it. I love you, Uncle Oswald. And when he read it, he said the Spirit of God just came upon him. And that was the birth out. He surrendered more to God, and that was the birth out of his potential psychic collapse. So through weakness, he moved into a deeper place of surrender to Jesus. And what a ministry this man's had after his wife Biddy wrote all his notes up. So theologians typically use this passage when they're talking about the prophetic potential of movements such as L'Arche and the Special Olympics and individual people with intellectual disabilities and physical, in particular intellectual. God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. And he was writing to the Greeks at the time, you see. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. He chose the lowly things and the despised things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. So people with intellectual disabilities speak prophetically into an age of intellectualism and self-dependence. Two cautions and concerns here that's brought up in the literature. This does not suggest that people with intellectual disabilities are foolish. It just interrogates and critiques the status quo and the values of our society. Second thing, we can never look at a person with intellectual disabilities objectively as somebody who's going to help us develop more virtues and fruits of the Spirit. Because then we objectify them and we don't give them the dignity that Jean Vanier gives them and says, you're a person valuable to me because you're made in the image of God and I can learn something from you. It's a big difference. Research in the Special Olympics, secular research shows this. Those people who interact on a regular basis with people with intellectual disabilities in particular grow in virtues that we might call the fruits of the Holy Spirit. Empathy, kindness, patience, love, Dick Hoyt, humility, love and grace that he'd learned through his relationship with his son. Thank you for the comment. Wonderful. I'm just going to talk very briefly. These are some of the themes in the literature. Nancy Eisland's book was the seminal one. She was in a wheelchair. She was a Christian sociologist. But this was the concept she brought to theology. God was disabled on the cross in the most profound way. And so disabled people can understand Jesus' message for them and he can speak to them. There are some theological issues there that theologians developing her work picked up on. I haven't got time to go into. It's an interesting concept that he's disabled on the cross. Yes, he went to glory and was resurrected. But when he was resurrected, he still had the wounds. And there's a whole lecture there. The other things that we've talked about, the importance of being made in the image of God's self-worth. I thought this was interesting. Exploration of fundamental gospel values. I've heard these terms. Hospitality, friendship, humility, mutuality, vulnerability. This is the core business of UK sports chaplaincy. And the last point, that perhaps on our PCC meetings, elders meetings, church councils, maybe how do we welcome the disabled into our churches should be on the agenda. So in summary of the theology of disability, there are four things that relate to this prophetic message. People with intellectual and physical disabilities are much more public and visible. So when I talked about the historical development of disability sport, we can see that on an international level, they're more relevant, they're more visible, so they can be a prophetic message. People are internationally recognised, large Special Olympics and so forth. Non-disabled persons are sharing their lives with others through LASH. We heard David say, was it Ewan, sorry, that when his mother's died, and he used this word, that it was the community of people in the disability sport context which allowed him to get through it. People with intellectual disability parodying intellectualism indeed. And then here's one I think we can learn from. People with intellectual disability, sorry, disabled people are gentling others. So this book by Gene Stallings, who was the coach of an NFL American football team, he was used to 6'4" men, 16 stone, American masculinity, American self-made man. And he was having a son and he was delighted because he'd had a number of daughters. And he was imagining this very masculine man who was going to be a footballer. And his son had Down syndrome. And he was utterly devastated. He was a Christian. It's a good book. And he was utterly devastated. But over a period of time, the Holy Spirit spoke into his life. And it radically changed the way that he approached all his players. And his son used to go into the dressing room. And through the book's narrative, his son had a huge influence on the lives of all these players in the NFL. An incarnational message. So, who's this handsome brute on the screen? Why and how should sport chaplains engage in disability sport? I have three thoughts before we break for coffee or discussion. Number one, do we have Jesus's mentality about the disabled in sport? I think this organisation does and is moving forward. A void exists. There are hundreds of sports disability organisations across the UK with very little sports chaplaincy input. Following Warren's advice about being intentional, let's go to the weak and poor and broken. As Vanier said, they have a message for us. And three, resources and training is needed and is emerging through the pioneering work of Steve and Heather and others. Celebrate it and make other people aware of it. Thank you for listening.